thousand times and more times than I can count, I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. I have a lot to share today. We're going to talk about something that you've heard me mention many times, acrylamides. There's a new study on it. I'm going to tell you about why you should be concerned. Manuka honey. There's a trick to fighting off the flu with it. And I'll also talk about DMSO. Most people have never heard of it. It's a forgotten natural treatment for cancer and other diseases. Then carrots contain a compound that boosts vision, prevents cognitive decline, and more. And what age do you begin to have brain decline? All right? Where you actually lose your mental powers. They dwindle substantially. If you know the age, call us. I'd like to see who's on top of this issue. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. If you know the age that the brain starts a decline. How Big Pharma hides vaccine dangers from parents, and a lot more, including olive leaf extract. That's just some of the health and nutrition information, but we have a lot also today on the environmental front, including an interesting article about with climate change, heat is more important than natural disasters driving people away. This is in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, our most prestigious scientific journal in America. Now, just imagine the heat in New York City if it goes up another 3 degrees in the summertime. Holding the heat, how's that going to work? What's it going to mean? I'll tell you. Also, we're going to look at the big victory as a court upholds small towns' rights to ban fracking. All the more reason that you should be reading the articles, watching the documentaries, and in joining the call to action to ban fracking in your community. You can do it now. The court is on your side. Therefore, before you couldn't, now you can, and we should. And you can go to blog.garynull.com, and you'll see all the articles. We have more articles, more documentaries, more information on more social issues than any other website I'm aware of in the world. So that's why we had the number. What was the number? I was just given that number yesterday. New people coming, listening to the show, reading articles, 800,000 in the last 4 weeks. 800,000 new. So people are using this information to empower themselves to make change. So the movements are with people. That's the movement. My guest in the second part of our program is going to challenge many people's views that our republic was created based upon the ideology of a Christian-based nation. He says, wrong. Not right at all. Who is he? Professor Matthew Stewart, an American philosopher, and he is attempting to rescue the discipline of philosophy and rational inquiry from the glass city of academics. He graduated from Princeton University in political philosophy and later received his doctorate from Oxford University. And so he's going to talk about this in depth. Also, I wanted to see how the media was covering the Obamacare challenge on birth control. I also wanted to see how they were covering the movement of the jihadist ISIS in Iraq. I use Bill O'Reilly as the template because almost everyone else on Fox after 6 o'clock, with the exception of Shepard Smith, who I believe is the most rational person on that station, but all the rest, Greta and all the others, Sean, they all follow the same stories, just with their own different takes, and almost always the same talking heads, all neocons, all people who have been historically wrong, many with extremely discredited backgrounds that are never brought up. In any case, he was asked, he asked this man, how would you deal with this? Would you go in there and stop them with air power or do nothing? Now, the assumption is you either do something with a military strike or you're doing nothing. At no point have I heard anyone in the media, including reading the New York Times today, who has a clue about why you're not going to be able to stop these people. Because it's not the 800 that were engaged in the current battle, or the 10,000 all over the whole region, including in Syria and other countries. It's because you don't understand them. You can't cure a disease if you don't understand what caused it. You can't help a person through emotional crisis unless you're aware of what precipitated the crisis. And we haven't even begun to talk in our society about what is their belief. Oh, well, we know their belief. We're told their belief. They want to create a single state that is based upon a single philosophy. No, that's not it. So today, time permitting, I'm going to share with you an understanding of Islamic fundamentalism from an accurate, historical, and scholarly perspective. So the next time you read the New York Times, you should question their lack of scholarship, or any of the media for that matter. The person who is responsible for these insights is William R. Polk, a member of the Policy Planning Council responsible for North Africa, the Middle East, and West Asia. For 4 years under President John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, he also was a member of the three-man Crisis Management Committee during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I also have a commentary I will share on this because I see it differently. And remember, I predicted at the beginning in 2003 what would happen to Iraq and also what would happen in Libya. Go back now and look at all the experts and then ask yourself, why do we still believe any of these people? They have been wrong about everything. And as far as Obamacare, after hearing these supercilious arguments about Obamacare, I presented last night a very comprehensive understanding of what's wrong with our entire medical industrial complex, Obamacare, the complicit input of our White House and Congress working hand-in-hand with the pharmaceutical industry, the for-profit hospital associations, and the insurance industry. And I brought in orthodox, not holistic, orthodox physicians with impeccable backgrounds. Now, these are the people who believe in the current medical model, including vaccines. And you'll have to hear this. Tomorrow I will play this on WBAI, our sister station. But then ask yourself, after you hear their input, mind you, these are the guardians of the gates of orthodoxy. And I wanted their input and challenge them on points. You've got to hear this discussion tomorrow, a full hour on what's wrong with our entire medical complex and Obamacare specifically. So that's tomorrow. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. When you eat a bagel, or a piece of toast, or a potato chip, or a french fry, or a piece of bread, what you're eating, besides something that tastes good and is traditional, you're eating acrylamide. Acrylamide is a very serious cancer-causing agent. And almost always with the traditional American diet, or European diet for that matter, you're also consuming meat with it, and that meat in the cooking process has created another form of cancer-causing agent, heterocyclic amines. Now, here is the latest from the European Food Safety Authority. This is their FDA. Quote, the European Food Safety Authority has confirmed previous evaluations that based upon animal studies, acrylamide in food potentially increased the risk of developing cancer for consumers in all age groups. Acrylamide in food is produced by the same chemical reaction that browns food also making it tastier. During everyday high temperature, 150 degrees, cooking or above, catering and food manufacturing, coffee, fried potato products, biscuits, crackers, crisps, soft bread, and certain baby foods are important dietary sources of acrylamide. On a body weight basis, children are the most exposed age group. European and national authorities already recommend reducing acrylamide in food as much as possible and provide dietary and food preparation advice to consumers. Today, the European Food Safety Authority is launching a public consultation on its draft scientific opinion on acrylamide in food, developed by the authority's expert panel on contaminants in the food chain. So there you have it. At least in Europe, they are protecting their citizens by letting them know, from good science, this is bad. Now, you've been hearing me talk about how bad these cook products are for a long time and how you should cook below 150. And by the way, you can do almost all cooking below 150. In fact, if you get it below 120, it's a raw living food. And that's why the dehydrators, the dehydrate kale and kale chips, those are about 115 to 120 degrees. But it takes a little more time. So the best way of doing it is overnight. But because we're a fast food nation and we're impatient, we want something instantly. And therefore, they cook it at high temperatures. And that's where the acrylamide comes from. You get all the brown, toasty stuff out of your diet, you're helping save yourself from cancer. But nothing will be done in the United States to inform the public of anything as dangerous, because that would be interfering with someone making a profit. Manuka honey is, quite simply, it is the best honey there is. Tupelo honey is also good. But raw, any form of raw honey, untouched organic honey by pesticides, is good. According to Dr. Victor Marchione from the Natural Blaze, he says that Manuka honey is as effective as Tamiflu, and that can help people prevent the flu. So I just read his piece, and I thought to myself, this is pretty good. Well, the study was published in the Archives of Medical Research, and the study observed that the H1N1 influenza strain, known as the AWSN3, which researchers have been very familiar with for quite some time now, in the study, they found that Manuka honey was able to, and not other honeys, was able to kill it. It had antiviral activity, and that's important. You know, with Manuka being so powerful, it was also tested to determine its ability to reduce the growth of influenza virus. And the Manuka honey worked perfectly as an influenza pre-treatment by stopping the virus in its tracks. There were also noticeable virus reductions when the MDCK cells were treated with Manuka and after the infection. Now, what makes Manuka honey and other kinds of honey so powerful when it comes to their antiviral abilities? Phytochemicals. All of you who are eating or drinking your green juices, red juices, you're getting loads of phytochemicals, particularly the flavonoids, phenolic acids, because they are definitely good against influenza. But the healing properties of Manuka honey don't end with influenza. It also has antibacterial, antimicrobial, anti-inflammatory, antiseptic, and antifungal qualities. Manuka is also known for its ability to heal minor burns and wounds when applied topically. The older you get, the more challenge your body has to repairing skin damage. Hence, you can have a sore for years. It just doesn't completely heal as it would have when you were younger. On those, put Manuka honey. If you have someone who's got bed sores, first spray the sore with colloidal silver and colloidal gold as well. Then put Manuka honey on it and watch over a period of 2 weeks what happens. So poison ivy, psoriasis, acne, eczema, bee stings. There was also an article published last year in the highly respected PLOS ONE. For a 24 to 72-hour period, the researchers treated cancer cells with various Manuka honey concentrations, and the results linked Manuka honey to reducing cancer cell growth in skin, colon, and breast cancers. I'd say that's important. A spoonful, a teaspoonful, has a lot of benefits. Helps digestion, helps with acid reflux, bloating, indigestion, irritable bowel syndrome. Helps with sinus infections, diabetes, your immune system, and helps with elevated cholesterol. Now, there is no one miracle food or miracle nutrient, but boy, it is one that can be used in combination. I believe in synergy, using a lot of different things together. So that's always have Manuka honey in your home. And I just mentioned flu, but there is a new article in the Sleuth Journal. I had this information and I used it in a film. But here's what the public is not aware of. In December of 2005, the British Medical Journal published a shocking report by Peter Dosh, which created tremors throughout the halls of the Center for Disease Control, where the so-called experts used to tell the press, and the press did not question it. And how many times have you heard them say, 36,000 people die every year from the flu? We've all heard it, right? Okay, well, I questioned it. I questioned why did they keep saying 36,000 instead of 32,000 or 45,000? There is no such thing as a constant when you're dealing with infectious disease. It has to fluctuate. And yet it was never fluctuating year after year. Here is from the actual report. Quote, according to the CDC, influenza and pneumonia took 62,034 lives in 2001. Okay, that's a lot of people, right? Here's what no headline, no one reported. This is in the article from the CDC. Quote, 61,777 of which were attributable to pneumonia. And 257 to flu. And in only 18 cases was the flu virus possibly identified, end quote. So let's go over this again. In all of 2001, flu and pneumonia deaths, only 18 revealed the presence of an influenza virus. Therefore, the CDC could not say with assurance that more than 18 people died of influenza in 2001, not 36,000 deaths. 18 deaths. Doshi continued his assessment of published CDC flu death statistics. Quote, between 1979 and 2001, data show an average of 1,348 flu deaths per year. These figures refer to flu separated out from pneumonia. This death toll is obviously far lower than the 36,000 figure, but it would drop much lower if you had the obvious need to confirm the presence of flu virus in those cases. And that can be confirmed. So we have been lied to. We have been manipulated. This is a massive, massive public health fraud. And the people responsible should go to jail. Because think of all the manufacturing of billions and billions of dollars of flu vaccines that are dangerous, that have mercury in them. And think of all the people who've been vaccinated thinking they were preventing the flu, all because of a scare tactic. Now the truth is known, and it's official, because we're only using their own statistics that were never made public. But it was published in the British Medical Journal. And it is from the CDC, so just remember this, only 18 confirmed flu deaths in 2001, not 36,000. So just think about that the next time you see an ad for getting your flu shot. I remember getting a call from a professor at Oregon State University asking about would I like to see some information on DMSO? That's when I was writing a series of articles on the politics of cancer, and he wanted to show how this very important substance, DMSO, was helping, and yet the politics of the cancer industry prevented him from publishing. He was a medical doctor and a researcher and a professor. This is from Natural Society, quote, an Oklahoma Natural Cancer Treatment Center, Camelot Cancer Care, has been using DMSO to treat patients and amazingly had managed to survive for a while in USA. It was finally shut down by the FDA and the FBI. And a major aspect of Camelot's orthomolecular treatment incorporated DMSO, which had been proven to carry compounds deeply and rapidly into tissue while also having its own properties that promote cancer cell death. Most normal cells are programmed for natural death as part of their cycle for allowing new cells to generate. Cancer cells don't have this property, so they claim immortality by never dying by themselves, eventually forming tumors. The explanation for the Camelot raid and shutdown was this. The clinic was using vitamin B17, or Laetril, an FDA substance banned for treating cancer. Laetril was banned even after it was proven safe and effective against cancer. And by the way, DMSO is called, it's dimethyl sulfoxide, and it's produced by oxygenating dimethyl sulfide, a byproduct of wood pulp processing. It was discovered by a Russian scientist in 1866 and considered useful as a solvent, and medical interest surfaced in the early 1960s at the Oregon Health and Science University Medical Center. Dr. Stanley Jacob, the gentleman who called me, discovered that DMSO could penetrate skin organ membranes without damaging them. And his research showed several topical analgesic applications for animals and humans. And he went further with injecting or ingesting DMSO for bladder malady and cystitis. In 1978, the FDA allowed DMSO to be used and for IC, and Dr. Jacob consumed a teaspoon of DMSO daily over 30 years and claimed perfect health. So just something that you should know is important out there. And by the way, for the FDA saying that Laetril or vitamin B17 was worthless, toxic. Not far from where I was doing my research at the Institute of Applied Biology was the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. A physician there, the oldest physician there, the oldest practicing physician and scientist there, Dr. Sugiera, spoke with me because he read the series I was doing. And I was introduced to him by one of the research scientists downstairs. I was upstairs in nutrition and anti-aging research. They were all using chemotherapy downstairs. And he was friends with Sugiera. And he said, I thought you'd find this interesting. So he said that in test after test, the ascites tumors in these rats he was using were substantially improved, and yet he couldn't get anything published on it. So that is, in fact, later, Ralph Moss, who's done a great deal to educate the American public about cancer therapies that work and don't work, came to me and said that he was, he worked at Sloan Kettering, and he said that important information was being suppressed. Couldn't get it out. So I asked Steve Dunleavy, who was a friend of mine, and he was the senior editor at the New York Post, and they met up in my apartment, and then there was a headline about this cancer treatment that opened up a whole can of worms for the cancer industry. But it allowed people to see that there was important therapies being repressed. And then all these other doctors started to come forward from all these other cancer institutes to talk with me about how, yeah, you can't do anything. It's natural. You have to do chemicals. You got to know who's behind all this. You got to know the pharmaceutical industry. They're paying for the research. They're affiliated. It's all about the patents. It's all about the drugs. and you can't patent a natural substance. I had so many people, physicians, scientists, who wanted to talk, but there was no whistleblower law then. They couldn't be protected. I'm going to post all my old articles. I think I had, I believe, I never went back and counted. I was told I had 48 cover stories, meaning featured on National Magazine, 48 different stories on the Politics of Cancer and Medical Genocide series. I'm going to post them all on blog.garynall.com later today. Go back and read them and see what has changed from the early 1970s till today. Carrots contain compounds that boost vision, prevent cognitive decline, and more. The carrot is native to Europe, and according to Natural News, it's been cultivated for over 2,000 years. And what we now know is that there are 7,800 international units of vitamin A in a single medium carrot. So when you have a glass of carrot juice, you're really pumping lutein and other nutrients important for your eyes and especially for the retina. So that's important. But it also, according to the Archives of Internal Medicine, can improve cognitive decline, improves memory, category fluency, and general cognition compared to a control group in a study. It's also being used for leukemia. According to a study published 2012 in the Anti-Cancer Agents and Medicinal Chemistry, three bioactive compounds found in carrots and carrot juice, namely the thalconerols, induce cell death, cancer cell death, on human lymphoid leukemia cell lines. That's good, and again, guards against heart disease. There was a 10-year comprehensive study from the Netherlands that found that colorful, antioxidant-rich fruits and vegetables are effective at treating cardiovascular disease. So all that's good. It's all about the carrot. And let's see if anyone has answered the... Did anyone answer the message here? No. Let's go to... All right, we have several here. Let's just see who got it right. Jamie. Jamie, what's your answer? Jamie's from New York, New Jersey. Jamie? Jamie said 26 years old. Richie, what's your answer?
My answer is 25 years old.
Okay. Well, let's split the difference. You're both 1 year off. Brain declines begins at 27. Mental power starts to dwindle, according to the BBC News, quote, at 27 after peaking at 22. That means you're starting old age at 27. All right, Professor Timothy Salthouse of the University of Virginia found reasoning, spatial visualization, and speed of thought all decline in our late 20s. So that's important. And this was published in the journal Neurobiology of Aging. Now, just imagine that's with normal people. How many individuals out there have lived lives where they've drank a lot of alcohol that kills brain cells by the hundreds of millions over a period of, let's say, when you get out of college? And then think of all the other things you eat. Think of the lack of sleep and think of the electromagnetic pulses from cell phones and computers. So I'm going to guess now, in the new era, if we looked at the average person, you're looking at probably around 23. Yeah, so now we know why most people have problems with memory and cognition in their mid-30s. Thank you both for calling in. I appreciate it. We're going to... I'm going to go to my guest in a moment, and I'd like for him to be able to hear some of the commentary I'm going to give, and then we're going to spend time with him. Let me just, I told you earlier about Dr. Matthew Stewart. I told you that he is an American philosopher, and he characterizes himself as the philosopher of the people. And he's attempting to rescue the discipline of philosophic and rational inquiry from the glass city of the academics. He graduated from Princeton University in political philosophy and later received his doctorate at Oxford University on scholarship. And his most recent book is Nature's God, The Radical Origins of the American Republic. It is probably the most thorough research publication to date about the rational founding of the American Republic, tracing its philosophical origins to the ideas of the ancient Greeks and Romans Enlightenment, contrary to the belief of so many of the conservative groups and to the strict fundamentalist groups. His website is mwstewart.com. We'll go to him in a moment, but what's important is we also have to understand the nature of the conflict that we're facing in the Middle East. And I don't believe people have pulled back. Certainly the people who are speaking from the government and from the media have not given the explanation that needs to be given. So with Bill O'Reilly last night saying, you know, use air power. Oh, yeah, we'd be careful because our technology is, you know, capable of just killing the ISIS people. Do you really think that's the answer? If using air power were the answer, then surely the largest, most powerful, and technologically advanced armed forces in the world would have defeated the non-technology, no ships, no planes, no tanks, nor Vietnamese. And they traveled on foot, and they had regular guns, and yet, in all that effort, the French and the Americans, in a 20-year battle, mind you, you have to understand that the French were there. And then we supported the French, and we gave $2 billion towards the French cause in that Indonesian conflict. And with the Battle of Binh Phu, where the French were defeated, had to leave, we had a chance to help Ho Chi Minh write a new constitution based upon our constitution. We rejected that, the neocons did. Instead, we continued the conflict, and it was already in process of destabilization before Kennedy announced our intents there. So it wasn't 10 years or 12 years. It was 20 years. And yet we didn't defeat them. We didn't defeat the Taliban. You can kill them. You can blow up this car and that car. It doesn't stop. Why? Because you're not dealing with just a soldier who's fighting for their country or national pride or paycheck. You better pull back far enough to understand who are these people and what are their beliefs. Now, according to William Polk, the word, the Arabic word used for fundamentalist belief in Islam is Salafiyya. And though it's now usually associated with revolutionary Islamic fighters, native Arabic speakers usually translate it to mean reactionary. But the concept is far more complex. The word Salafi in classical Arabic means a person who stands both in the rear guard and in the vanguard. Ah, that's Arabic in its contrast, duality. Weakness, they believed, came from the innovations and perversions that encrusted Islamic thought and Islamic society in the long dark ages of decline of its power and civilization. So here's what we're dealing with today. The movements of purification were inspired by such men as the Arabian Abdul Wahhab, the Algerian Mohammed Ben Ali Sensuous, the Sudanese, the Iranian activists, and the Egyptian theologian Mohammed Abdullah. In a fundamental aspect, their teachings and movements resemble those set off in Northern Europe by Martin Luther or Calvin. These Christians and Muslims shared a belief in the absolute authority of the unalterable Word of God as presented in the original text. So their task was to go back to discover the pure message and lead their followers to implement it. However, they did differ. Both the Muslims and Protestants were in this sense Salafis. The original text, the Old Testament and the Quran, reflected primitive tribal Jewish and Arab societies, and the codes they set forth were severe. They aimed, in the Old Testament, at preserving and enhancing tribal cohesion and power. And in the Quran, at destroying the vestiges of pagan belief and practice. Neither early Judaism nor Islam allowed deviation. Both were authoritarian theocracies. But over the centuries, both outgrew their original isolation and came to deal with diverse societies and beliefs, and thus in practice both became more ecumenical and put aside or modified many of the original concepts. In the eyes of some theologians, such modifications amounted to perversions of God's commandments. So throughout history, a few religious scholars have sought to go back to the original pure message as their ancestors had received it, as they believe from God, and as they had enforced it. Now, these attempts to return reached a large body of believers in Europe in the 16th, 17th centuries, and the Middle East in the 19th, 20th centuries. Thus, the Old Testament inspired New England Puritans implemented a draconian, biblically-based legal code. Should we forget? Then in the United States, they engaged in lashings, burnings, stoning to death for crimes such as adultery and sodomy and blasphemy. Today's militant Muslim fundamentalists, similarly, have insisted on a literal interpretation of early Islamic practice. Indeed, some, like the Taliban, have also sought to implement anew what were primitive non-Islamic tribal codes, Pashto, or to insist, like several African societies, on implementing tribal customs even when they were not sanctioned by Islamic law. The ancestors of a vast majority of today's Christians and Jews and Muslims eventually relaxed, and in the aftermath of their Puritan movements, subsequent generations turned away from what their fathers and grandfathers had sought to impose. In effect, they found other less draconian ways to accomplish their social and cultural objectives. Others held firm. So among some Christian sects, the old believers, the born-again Christians, what do you think a born-again Christian is? I come from the born-again Christian town, and all the churches pride themselves on being born again. That means they are Old Testament revivalist. They believe that every word in there is the real word of God, and if you deter your living actions from it, then you're engaging in heresy. In many Protestant groups, you've heard the Return Movement. It's one of the biggest movements in the United States. The Return is a powerful rallying call. It was even more so for Muslims. That is because many of their more influential thinkers believe that Islam itself faced an existential challenge in the era of imperialism and colonialism. For Muslims and other cultural groups in Africa and Asia, the challenge was clear and present. So, then you have to look at who were the ones who were the source of this current militancy. Don't look at anything happening today as originating today. These have been going on throughout the centuries. The inspiration for the current version of Islamic activity, particularly for its militant wing, has come mainly from the Egyptian, partly American-educated, religiously learned man named Qutb. He was born in an Egyptian village in 1906, got his early education in primary school in a village, and then in a secular school in Cairo. And during his 20s and 30s, he wrote a memoir of village life. He later came to the United States. He studied for 2 years at the University in Colorado, then went to California. And everywhere he went in America, he was appalled by what he saw. In his eyes, America was a cesspool of wasteful consumption, exaggerated sex, and crass materialism. So putting together all he found to detest about America, he placed American civilization in an Arabian context. It was like the pre-Islamic Arabian period of ignorance of God's ways, which was reformed through the actions of God's messenger, Muhammad. In this way, he categorized the West, not Islam, as the retrograde society. Well, today's Muslims, he argued, must reinstate the pattern and practices of the order announced by Muhammad in the 7th century. That is, Muslims must go back to the original pattern, Muhammad's community, in order to correct today's excesses. Only then can they be moving ahead. And that's the true meaning of their movement. So I won't go any further on this because I just wanted to give you a little perspective on what I see as one of the substantial limitations in trying to figure out how to deal with people who are motivated by what they see as the impurities within other Muslim sects, and hence the Sunni-Shia rivalries. The leaders who had a very short rule, there were only four that lasted a relatively short period of time, but they want to resurrect that because of the purity that that represented. They're pure ideologists. How do you negotiate with them? How do you communicate with them? You better understand what their principles are if you're going to try to have any communication, because otherwise all you're going to have is a bloody, unstoppable movement. Let's say hello to Matthew Stewart. Nice to have you with us today.
It's great to be here, Gary.
Would you, before we get into our discussion, which is the heretical origins of the American Republic and its challenge to the ideology of a Christian-based nation, would you like to comment on any of the things just discussed?
Yes, I would, Gary. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. And you struck on a number of themes that resonate deeply with me. You mentioned philosophy first, and you said that I'm trying to take philosophy out of the glass cage of the academy. There's some truth in that. It's my conviction that philosophy changed the world, and that's one of the fundamental points that I want to make in this book, that it had a dramatic impact and that we are living with the consequences. But the philosophy that I have in mind involves an increase in awareness. It's essentially about a synthesis or an improvement in our understanding taken in its broadest sense. It's not necessarily a specialized contribution to knowledge of the sort that fits in well with university department. And then that connects, I think, in an important way with the point that you're making about theocracy and about how difficult it is to have a modern government that is in some way motivated through religion, and especially religion that's based on revelation. The great accomplishment of our founders was to open up the possibility for true self-government, where we approach our problems through reason, we deliberate on them, and we build our policies, build our institutions on the basis of what we find in the world. And they understood that in order to do that, we have to break with a significant part of the old religious model. We don't necessarily break entirely from all forms of religion or spirituality, but we certainly break from the idea that revealed scriptures, fundamental texts of the kind that you were mentioning, that those are the sources of our authority, and that if we can just go back into those ancient scriptures and decode them properly, we will know what to do. And I think that they also understood through their philosophy that this religious complex, this sort of traditional aspect of human behavior, is rooted in things that are highly problematic. I mean, the search for purity that you mentioned, I mean, that drives a great deal of anxiety, and it drives a great deal of oppression. When you make that a guiding principle of the political order, you get chaos, you get civil war, and you get destruction. And I think philosophy in the American context was absolutely essential in opening up new possibilities for us. So that, I think you hit on a lot of the main themes of my book, and also themes that are just very important for everybody to think about now, since we are, after all, facing a resurgence of theocratic-style movements around the world.
I appreciate that. I'm hearing constantly of people making moral judgments upon anyone who does not follow their scripture, and then they have power within our body politic. Every one of the previous administrations, going clear back to Ronald Reagan, have given hundreds of millions of dollars to what are called faith-based initiatives. All the legislators meet with these faith-based people on a regular basis. This is not known to the public. And they'll have dinners together. They'll have breakfasts together. And the message is simple. We will get our congregation to vote for you. If you vote in behalf of us on these issues, these are the laws we want. These are the laws we don't want. And this has been going on for some time. So I want to go back, because they keep saying that that our government was founded based upon these faith-based principles. And I say not. So my question to you is this. With so much being said today about the Christian founding of the United States by the Founding Fathers, this is a very thorough book you've written, 600-page tome discrediting any such belief. In fact, through copious research, you have done something I don't believe anyone else has. Maybe they have. I haven't read it. We continue to hear from our elected officials, particularly on the political right, that the United States was founded by Christian principles. Today, we hear that many of our military officers are expounding the rationale for the U.S. invading Afghanistan and Iraq in theological terms as a crusade between Christianity and Islam, as a satanic versus or evil faith. What all these politicians such as Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Sarah Palin, Paul Ryan, and so many others in the Fox Media refuge, they simply refuse to acknowledge is the historical background of the founding of the nation and the intellectual sources the fathers of this nation drew upon for their inspiration to free the colonies from the British crown. And many journalists and scholars have commented on the lack of any acknowledgement of Christianity, God, and Jesus in the Constitution, and clearly bars all laws, quote, respecting an establishment of religion. The only reference the religious right has to draw from is the single reference to the Creator in the Declaration of Independence. But then the question is, what kind of Creator and from which religion, philosophy, or belief does the Creator originate? And this points directly to what has been called the question. What is this dark question which has been used to usurp the truth of the Constitution versus the Christian right and in reinterpretation into distinctly Christian terms that support their ideological claims to the U.S. government and Christianity belong together? So the Bible should be a part of the Constitution. The Constitution evolved from the Bible. This is nonsense. This is not what the secular principles of enlightenment that Jefferson and Franklin, Washington, John Adams, Thomas Paine, and others saw themselves adherents to. So would you take us through this in detail?
Well, that's an awful lot to go through in detail, but you're hitting on many central points. So one is that the resources that we need in order to confront and debunk these frankly grotesque misinterpretations of American history are right there in the words of the founders themselves. So Thomas Jefferson himself was confronting efforts by ministers and by the sort of zealous religious right of his time, and he confronted them directly and explained why their hands should be kept off the levers of power. So that's a first general point. But then perhaps more important for me is that there's more than just a polemic at stake here. The issue is more than just that the Christian right is misappropriating a lot of American history. It's that we have this amazing history. America's philosophical history is much richer, much more sophisticated, and much bolder than I think most people give it credit for. And one specific example that I think I can elaborate on is that reference to the Creator and to nature's God that appears in the Declaration of Independence. So those phrases, the laws of nature and of nature's God, and the notion that we all men are created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that has certainly been appropriated by conservative and authoritarian forces to claim that, you know, God, meaning almost always, oh, in fact, always their God, issued commands that America's founders followed. In fact, we can trace that very precisely, that language, the concepts, the entire context, we can trace it to the preceding history of philosophy, and specifically to the tradition that's called deism. So the Declaration of Independence is this amazing deist manifesto. Now, deism itself has also been misinterpreted or appropriated. It's been viewed as a sort of Christianity light, a sort of a way of saying, well, the founders, they may not have followed our religion to the T, but they were nonetheless, you know, they were with us and not with those nasty secularists. But that turns out to be deeply false. It is true that their position was complex and it had certain elements of what we today would call religion, but it was actually quite radical and deeply rationalistic. And the interesting thing is that when you trace these phrases like nature's God, like self-evident, like unalienable rights. When you trace them through the preceding history, what you find is that the crucial points of development all pass through the philosophers who were, in their own time, the scariest individuals around. So if I may, I'll just mention some of those names, because people who are familiar with the history will immediately grasp what I'm talking about. It turns out that the most important or earliest precursor of the American experiment is the ancient Greek philosopher Epicurus. Now, Epicurus was known for 2,000 years as the most famous or infamous atheist in history, and that's because he was committed to the idea that everything in the world follows natural laws or laws of cause and effect, and everything is therefore explicable, and it's our place in the world to try to understand it, that the world does not work for us, but rather we have to go out and engage with it to try to understand it, work with one another, and not count on some sort of miracles or divine revelations coming from above. That was Epicurus's basic message, and he is the progenitor of the line of thought that culminated in the American Revolution. And a couple of other figures that I will just throw out that really played a fascinating and important role are Giordano Bruno, very important because he brought back the Epicurean philosophy into the early modern world. He, in particular, put emphasis on the infinite universe and the belief in space aliens, which, by the way, America's founders shared because they were bold in that way. They were willing to entertain the possibility of extraterrestrial life on other planets. And he was, of course, burned at the stake. And he was burned at the stake because his ideas threatened the authoritarian theocratic order that existed in his time. And then the last figure I'll mention, who is usually not usually doesn't count in most American philosophical histories, but who I think is quite important, is Spinoza. And there again, you have a figure who, in his own time, was persecuted, was regarded as the most vile thing that hell vomited on the earth, and yet it's in his ideas and his boldness, his courage in confronting the authoritarians of his day that you can find these seminal ideas, such as the idea of nature's God. And in fact, the phrase nature's God basically follows exactly that path. It's first conceived by Bruno, it's developed by Spinoza, it's passed along by English philosophers like John Locke, and it shows up in the Declaration of Independence.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. Two of your favorite early American rebels who embodied this spirit of the Enlightenment were Ethan Allen and Thomas Paine. Why did these best exemplify this secular, heretical trend to assure the separation of church and state?
So these are two really fascinating characters, and in fact, my own project has a kind of sentimental attachment to them because the whole thing began about 10 years ago when I came across the book that's known as Ethan Allen's Bible. So Ethan Allen was this rough mountain man, not a furniture magnate, that has nothing to do with him. He was famous as the leader of the Green Mountain Boys. He was completely self-taught. And he was also an infidel. That is to say, he quite explicitly rejected the Christian religion, and he called himself a deist, although he said he never read any deist books. Well, on retiring from the war, he sits down and writes a book. And it's not just any book. It's a 477-page book of philosophy. I read this book. I'm probably the first person to have read it closely in 100 years. And for me, it was a shock, and it was fascinating because even though it's not a great book, it's deeply informed, and it's incredibly bold. It's deeply informed in the sense that he brings up a number of arguments, tropes, and phrases that come directly from this tradition of radical philosophy that I was just describing. And it's quite bold in that he is just willing to face down the religious authoritarians of his day. Thomas Young, the book was so interesting that many later historians said, well, Ethan, old Ethan, that mountain man, couldn't possibly have written it. So they pinned the blame on this guy, Thomas Young. Very few people have heard of Thomas Young, and yet he is something like the Zelig of the American Revolution. He shows up everywhere that matters and has a decisive effect. So he was a leader of the Sons of Liberty in 1765, kicked off the Stamp Act riots. He then kicks off the Boston Tea Party. He's actually the person who stands up in front of the group as one of the leaders of the radical faction and says to the people of Boston, we have to throw this tea into the harbor. He then shows up in Philadelphia, where he leads the Pennsylvania Revolution of May 1776, absolutely essential for getting the Declaration of Independence passed. And then he's a co-author of the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776. So why haven't you heard of this guy? Well, partly because he was also an infidel. But more than that, what you see in his writings, more so than even in the case of Ethan Allen, is this very deep connection between the rationalist philosophy that he espouses and that he gets directly from these English and Dutch and earlier radicals, the direct connection between that and the political philosophy on which the American experiment was based, the very same ideas that show up in the preamble of the Declaration of Independence and that later play an important role in the formation of the U.S. Constitution. So those were two figures that really got me going. They got me excited. But then I went from there to looking at a number of others, some of them also forgotten, like Philip Freneau. He was called the poet of the American Revolution. He was quite famous in his own time. He was Thomas Jefferson and James Madison's sort of right-hand man on the press. He was sort of their press officer. And he was also a pantheist and a deep philosopher whose ideas are directly linked to the revolutionary cause. And then I also looked at some of the more famous founders, like Jefferson, Franklin, Paine, people who made a contribution to that radical change in government that took place during the American Revolution. And I found the same sets of ideas, the same genealogies going into them. And so I guess my general message, and I could go on like this for several hours, which is why the book is 600 pages long, but my general message is that these were very sophisticated, very bold, very informed thinkers, and they were philosophically informed, and it was that philosophical aspect of their activity that was decisive in the American Revolution. And just to be clear on one last point on this, I'm focused on the revolutionary part of the American Revolution. So Thomas Paine, for example, said that the whole American thing wouldn't really have mattered all that much if it was just a struggle for independence, if it was just about breaking free from Great Britain. What was interesting, what really matters, is that there was a revolution in the form and principles of government. Abraham Lincoln agreed with that, and I agree with Lincoln and Paine. That's the interesting part. So there's a whole part of the War of Independence, of the tri-corner hats and the Whigs and the whites of their eyes and all that sort of stuff that is interesting in a historical way, but it's kind of parochial. But if you look for what really matters, for what changed in the world, I think it's the part that is directly linked to this deeply rationalistic and essentially secular philosophy of America's bolder founders.
Matthew, I appreciate these inputs. I would just add one caveat for those who believe completely, the true believers who want to return to that radicalized view of the Puritans, that America is based upon Christian ideology, have them read the Treaty of Tripoli, signed by the U.S. and the Ottomans in 1797. Here's the exact wording in respect to religion. Quote, "The government of the United States is not in any sense founded on a Christian religion, as it is in itself no character of against the laws, religion, or tranquility of the Muslimin," end quote. At the time, the statement was printed on the front page of newspapers around the world with no outcry from the American churches or populace. And since many of the American churches at the beginning of the Republic supported the secular political philosophy adopted by the government, then you have to ask, what has happened that today so many have gotten it so wrong? Thank you very much, Matthew Stewart. All the best. The book is Nature's God. Appreciate you being with us today. I'm Gary Nall. That brings up the end of this program, and I want to thank you all for listening, and we look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now let's say hello in studio New York City to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, I am very excited to make this announcement today. People have been emailing me. I don't really bring it up, but they've been asking you if you would ever consider opening up the Tri-State Healing Center again in Manhattan. And it looks like we have an opportunity to do that. Before we make that decision, though, I need to see Do we have practitioners out there in your audience who are willing to be part of this? I'm looking for physicians, orthomolecular psychiatrists, acupuncturists, massage therapists, chiropractors, people that work with homeopathics. If you're interested in becoming a part of the Tri-State Healing Center, I want you to give me a call. My number is 631-504-6198. Again, 631-504-6198 if you have an interest in this.
Good. Maybe there's some holistic practitioners. It was 20 years ago that the Tri-State Healing Center served almost 3,000 people. We had 16 clinicians, medical doctors, Almira Gadol, the holistic dentist, one of the finest in America. We had a large group of people serving the public interest. That's where we helped over 1,300 people with full-blown AIDS regain their health in varying degrees. Some were completely reversed and are totally healthy, HIV negative today. We had people with all kinds of disease, but when the lease was up, I let it go and went on to other things. Today, I've been asked so many times, are you ever going to do it again? It depends upon getting the right therapist. Would I do it? Yes, because there's a need for it. So if you're a therapist or you know a therapist, give Luann a call. Luann, give you your number?
Surely, 631-504-6198.
Good, thank you. Let's say hello to Utrice. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Luann. Today, Paul DiRienzo files the sixth of his reports on America's largest environmental catastrophe, the nuclear reactor site in Hanford, Washington. And a lawyer representing workers at nuclear reactors discusses what whistleblowers have revealed about Hanford and about other U.S. nuclear programs.
Good. We look forward to this. Right now, Utrice Lead.
You better stop, yeah!